with, it says in the papers, here's Valerie Cox.
The special status of the President makes the lead for the Irish Examiner this morning, where Sean Connolly reports that the anti-austerity TD, Paul Murphy, has been condemned from across the political spectrum for insisting the President is a legitimate target for protest. The controversy erupted after a video emerged of anti-water charge protesters chasing after the President's car and verbally abusing Michael D. Higgins as he left to school. I voted for Michael D. Water protesters' ludicrous excuse. That's the lead for the Irish Daily Mail. Senan Maloney reporting that protester Derek Byrne admitted he voted for Mr. Higgins to be president in 2011. No excuse for attack on our president, says the paper's editorial. The protests that ultimately forced the government to backtrack on the water issue involved thousands of people taking to the streets. It's worth remembering it was entirely peaceful, it says. And Derek Byrne also makes an appearance on the front of the Herald under the headline, I'm not afraid of jail. And verbal abuse is the subject of a piece in the Irish Daily Mirror, where Cathal McMahon reports that Gardaí will launch a series of random checks after a lollipop lady was verbally abused by parents. Children at St Bridget's National School in Drogheda, County Louth, have been handed an official letter stating that parents are driving carelessly and parking in a dangerous manner in bus lanes and on footpaths. And it went on to claim that the traffic warden had been subjected to horrific abuse. Germany should accept that making payments to poorer Eurozone countries is in its own interests. That's according to the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, and it comes from an interview with Arthur Beasley in the Irish Times. On a flying visit to Dublin, Carney said that currency unions need risk sharing across all constituent parts of the currency union. It's unrealistic to expect all of that risk sharing to be taken on by the private sector, he said. Mortgage income cap will lock couples out of the market, says the Irish Independent. Typical working couples will be approved for €100,000 less in mortgage borrowings under new central bank rules, says Charlie Weston. In a double whammy for home buyers, as well as having to come up with a bigger deposit, thousands are set to have their property dreams crushed by the mortgage income caps. The new rules were anticipated by house buyers like a visit to the dentist, writes Dan Buckley in The Examiner. Fear of the torture to come, followed by an immediate sense of relief that the pain was not so bad after all, at least for some. For better or worse, and for all sorts of reasons, Cromwellian dispossession, the famine, and our colonial past have all been cited as contributors to our genetic love for the keys to our own front doors, writes Philip Nolan in the Mail. We are wedded to the idea of ownership rather than renting. The Irish Daily Star leads with a continuing trial of Graham Dwyer. And the Mirror and the Irish Sun both lead with the shooting of a Limerick Garda who was on holiday in New Orleans. He was blasted in the leg and lower back when he refused to hand over $200 that he withdrew from an ATM, says the Mirror. In other stories, the Sun and the Herald report that a woman whose daughter has spina bifida has slammed the HSE's refusal to give the family a medical card as disgraceful. Elaine Keogh reports that the seven-year-old, Sophie Biggins, who also has hydrocephalus, has been refused a medical card on three occasions. Finally, Deglan de Bredoun writes his final column in The Sun this morning. Slán a Guiv Golair. Goodbye to each and every one of you, he writes. Or, as film star Humphrey Bogart might have put it, we'll always have Leinster House.
Valerie, thank you very much indeed. Good morning, Conor Brophy.
Morning, Audrey. The European Commission says Ireland could have set more ambitious deficit reduction targets to help get the national debt down to a more sustainable level in its latest post-bailout programme report. The Commission says economic growth here may beat its forecasts for the year ahead and that Ireland is still likely to hit its deficit goals. But it says the ratio of debt to economic growth is still high, implying that more aggressive spending and taxation measures might have put it more firmly on a downward path in the Commission view. Facebook's fourth quarter revenue was up 49%, but its shares dropped in after-hours trading following the publication of results overnight. Investors, it appears, are concerned that the company's expenses, $2.7 billion of them in that most recent quarter, are rising at an even faster pace than its revenue. That $2.7 billion is 87% higher than in the same period last year. Facebook is spending big on research and development and on stock payouts to staff. The social network says it's currently bringing in about $9 per quarter from North American users, but the overall average revenue per user is $2.81, indicating that European, Asian and African users are significantly less lucrative for the company at present. The importance of the US market underlined by Facebook as it announced plans to deliver real-time ads during Sunday's Super Bowl, American football's championship game and the most watched television event of the year stateside. That means targeting Facebook users who are watching the game and scanning the social network on their mobile phones at the same time, with ads linked to the game and triggered by certain keywords mentioned in their news feeds. More on that at 10 to 8. The Bank of England Governor Mark Carney criticised the timidity of Eurozone leaders in tackling the debt crisis at a speech in Dublin last night. The central banker said there's only so much monetary policy can achieve. Europe's leaders do not currently foresee fiscal union as part of monetary union, he said. Such timidity has costs. Mr Carney was delivering the Jim Flaherty lecture commemorating the late former Canadian finance minister. The euro this morning trading at $1.128 and 74.5 sterling.
Connor, thank you very much indeed. As you may have heard in the bulletin, the Taoiseach's Department, the Department of Social Protection, has written to the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform to say it needs extra resources to administer a non-means-tested €100 water conservation grant. Well, we asked the Minister, Joan Burton, to come on to the programme, but she's not available to us this morning. But the Independent TD, Catherine Murphy, is. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Now, it seems at its core here is that the 100 grant, which every household receives or should receive from September, to be administered by the Department of Social Protection, the Department of Social Protection is saying, we don't have the budget to do that work.
Yep. And essentially, I'm not surprised at the information that has been forthcoming, because some of the questions were questions that were raised in the context of the debate before Christmas. Every household in the country that is a primary resident, whether it's people who are renting or people who are homeowners, has an entitlement to apply for this. That's 1.65 million households. The government estimates that 1.3 million households will apply for it. And that's a wider, as they would say themselves, a wider client base than any other of the social welfare payments. And it was very obvious that there would be a need for additional resources within the department if you weren't going to impact negatively on, claimants for social welfare payments and the time frame that the decisions are made there.
Is the nub of this, in your view, that if the payment were means tested, the Department of Social Protection could do that work probably quite easily? It knows who is in need of money around the country in terms of means tested payments. But the fact that it's so much wider, but everybody is included irrespective of their income level, makes this just a nightmare.
Yeah, look, this is an exercise in creative accounting. That's what I said in the Dáil yesterday in relation to this water conservation grant. It has nothing to do with water conservation. It's everything to do with satisfying the Eurostat test in relation to Irish water. Irish water, what this was pretty much a sweetener to encourage people to sign up to Irish Water. Irish Water has to have in excess of 50% of its own income to satisfy that test. They have to issue bills, and they will issue a bill, say, for a household with more than one person of €260 per year. Now, to encourage people to pay it, this water conservation grant was introduced, so as it can show that Irish Water can issue, the test actually is about the amount that you issue in rather than the amount that you collect.
Indeed, but the core of this issue today is that the Department of Social Protection is saying to the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform via the Secretary General link, if you like, the route, but they don't have the money to do the work.
Yes, exactly. So essentially, the whole Irish water issue in relation to social protection, has the cost of it has been understated, because what they haven't counted is, they haven't counted legal and procurement costs, and the procurement costs are probably going to be another piece of computer software to process this. There's going to be staff costs in relation to the people who are going to process, because it can't be accommodated within the social protection budget allocation. So essentially, we have this grant that is a water conservation grant, that when you receive it, you can go out on a night out. You can spend it on, a bill.
You can do whatever
it.
You wish. You might even choose to conserve water with it, or introduce some sort of system,
indeed,
or go towards that.
Yeah.
What would you suggest the government does?
Look, Irish water is an absolute fiasco from beginning to end.
Or a very necessary piece of guaranteeing the future of the water supply, depending on what side of the fence. That's your view. But what should the government do to get around this issue in terms of making sure that the water conservation grant gets to the people who need it from September when it falls due to be paid?
Look, this is not about means testing a water conservation grant. And I questioned in the Dáil yesterday the economics of Irish water, because when you actually strip out the actual costs of Irish water itself and the like of the water conservation grant, in actual fact, the net amount that's available to fix the leaky pipes and the inadequate water treatment plants, in actual fact, there's very little to invest in that, and you would be far better off going back to the drawing board and abandoning what has been an absolute fiasco. And this is just another element of that fiasco.
We leave it there. Catherine Murphy, Independent TD, thank you very much for joining us this morning. The time is...
It's an unusual scene. Negotiations for prisoner releases in return for people's lives being played out in public. That's what's happening between Jordan and the Islamic State militants at the moment. IS has demanded the release of an Iraqi prisoner held by Jordan by sunset tonight. If not, it says, it will kill a Jordanian pilot whom it's holding. IS has made no reference to a Japanese prisoner, Kenji Goto, whose voice is supposedly on a video clip making the demands on its behalf. The Iraqi prisoner is Sajida al-Rashawi, who was sentenced to death in Jordan for killing 60 people in a bomb attack in the capital Amman in 2005. Fawaz Gurgis is Professor of Middle East Relations at the London School of Economics, and he's on the line now. Professor Gurgis, first of all, is Jordan under pressure here to agree a deal from home? Because this pilot who's being held by IS, he's from a very powerful tribe, very powerful family in Jordan.
Very, very much. What the so-called Islamic State has done is to create a major domestic crisis, not only for the Jordanian government, but even for the Japanese prime minister. ISIS, or the so-called Islamic State, is playing domestic and foreign policy and using the hostages as a potent and effective foreign policy tool against the Jordanian government. Just to give you listeners an idea about the pressure under which the Jordanian government is under. Yesterday, hundreds of this powerful tribe, to which the pilot, the captured pilot, his name is Muaz al-Kasasiba, not only protested in front of the presidential, the royal palace and the government, but even explicitly threatened that if the pilot is not released, there would be a revolt in Jordan, that basically a major, major revolt against the government and the king personally. This tells you a great deal why the Jordanian government responded immediately, because this particular tribe, the tribe that the pilot belongs to, is part of the social base on which the Jordanian government depends. And this tells us a great deal how the strategy of ISIS has evolved in the last few months, from initially using hostages for ransom money, now to really playing big politics and international relations with the lives of hostages.
And we also have to bear in mind, don't we, that Jordan has a majority Sunni population, and King Abdullah of Jordan is very much part of the Western coalition against Islamic State.
Not only the family and the tribe of the pilot, Muaz, have basically directly warned that if the pilot is not released, and they have held the Jordanian government responsible, this is the irony, they have explicitly called on the Jordanian government to pull out of the international coalition led by the United States. Again, this tells you, obviously, that ISIS is going to play it and keep on playing it, because obviously it's producing results. And the Japanese prime minister, too, has come under tremendous pressure by the public opinion in Japan for providing $200 million in assistance for some of the countries who are facing the onslaught by ISIS. Again, there is a direct relationship between the demands of ISIS and the domestic crisis faced by both the Jordanian government and the Japanese government.
I mean, this is very dangerous for Jordan. The region around it is imploding. It's full of Palestinians. It's full of Syrian refugees. How can King Abdullah stop it being the next country in the region to erupt?
Well, you're absolutely correct. Jordan is in the eye of the storm. It faces major social, political and economic problems. I mean, you're talking about abject poverty, huge unemployment. You have this divide between Palestinians and Jordanians. It has about 800,000 Syrian refugees. It's also extremists of the ISIS variety have a base, a major base. We're talking about thousands of followers. In fact, the third largest contingent fighting with ISIS are Jordanian, 2,089 Jordanian fighters. Most of them basically play leadership role both in ISIS and al-Nusra Front. Al-Nusra Front is the official arm of al-Qaeda. This tells you about the challenges facing the king and how he is trying to walk a fine line while being in the international coalition led by the United States. Now he has to rethink his own strategy and make sure that Jordan does not really is not really overwhelmed by the multiple challenges, both from the inside and the outside.
And how much is he directly responsible for the increased security risk in his own country? Because he has adopted a very different stance on political Islam, on militants, than his father, King Hussein, has.
Well, I mean, King Hussein's major goal was to really, survival. This is a very small country. It's very poor in resources. It's in the eye of the fierce regional struggles, including the Arab-Israeli conflict, Iraq, Syria, what have you. King Abdullah has taken a much more, you might say, muscular approach. By joining the American-led coalition, Jordan basically needs resources, and the Americans and the Saudis and the Emiratis have provided Jordan with very precious economic resources. So again, he faces a similar predicament, but he also, particularly the king himself, believes that Arab countries, Arabs and Muslims, must stand up and basically defend what he called moderate middle Islam, as opposed to the extremist Islam championed by ISIS. So he feels it's the moral duty of Arabs, and Sunni Arabs in particular, to wage this war. This is about the future of moderate Islam, and Jordan is an integral part of this particular fight.
Well, thank you very much indeed for your analysis this morning. Fawaz Gergay is Professor of Middle East Relations at the LSE. We can go to Japan now and hear the views on their hostage who's being held by Islamic State. David McNeil is a journalist in Tokyo. David, what's the view there? Are they worried that their man will get left out of these negotiations between Jordan and Islamic State?
Well, yes. I mean, the government is keeping its cards very close to its chest. But talking to people off the record, what they say is they've sort of essentially been reduced, the government, that is essentially being reduced to the role of onlooker in this drama, because it seems to be played out now between Jordan and the Jordanian government and IS. And the Japanese government, of course, is just immensely worried about the fate of its own citizen, Kenji Goto. But he seems to have dropped out of the picture for now, because this pilot, of course, and the al-Qaeda prisoner on death row are the two people who are the main characters in this drama for now.
And what is public opinion Whose side is it on there? Do they want their government to negotiate with IS?
Well, that's a complicated question. And I mean, I think that most people feel that the government could be doing more to help rescue Kenji Goto. There is a large element of public opinion that says that the two, because one of these Japanese citizens has already been executed, but that they got themselves into this mess and that they really are responsible for their own fate. But the longer this goes on, you know, I think that this will be very difficult for Mr. Abe. Basically, if Mr. Goto, the remaining hostage, is freed, then it will be seen as a victory for Mr. Abe because he has taken a no compromise attitude to the drama, and he has said that he will not negotiate. If Mr. Goto is released, then that play will have seem to have won, I suppose. If he, on the other hand, the worst happens and he's executed, then I think public opinion will come down very heavily against Mr. Abe.
David, thank you very much indeed. David McNeil, journalist in Tokyo, brings the time to Just Ask. And Des is here with all the sports news.
Morning, Audrey. We've lots of live sport this morning, and we now know the lineup for the women's final at the Australian Open tennis. Serena Williams will face Maria Sharapova for the title. From Melbourne, here's the BBC's Russell Fuller.
Yes, Sharapova very impressive against Yekaterina Makarova, her fellow Russian, winning 6-3, 6-2. The eighth game of the first set really stands out. Makarova had just broken back and Sharapova unleashed a series of spellbinding returns to regain the initiative. And then Serena Williams, after a fabulous first set with 19-year-old Madison Keys, there was some amazingly powerful serving and some heavy hitting in that set, which Williams won on the tiebreak. Took the second set 6-2, but did need to wait for her ninth match point.
Next up, Andy Murray plays Thomas Berdych in the men's semi-final. That's starting about 8:30. Meanwhile, in golf, Rory McIlroy and Darren Clarke have started well in the Dubai Desert Classic. McIlroy's in fourth place. He's 4 under par after 12 holes, but that's still 3 shots behind the early leader, Nicholas Coulthard, who's gone to 8 under par after 16 holes. That's fantastic shooting from him. Andy Sullivan of England is 7 under. And Darren Clarke is 3 under, still in the top 10. Damian McGrain, 1 under after 7 holes. In soccer, Tottenham survived a strong fight back from League One side Sheffield United to set up a League Cup final with Chelsea after another late goal from Christian Eriksen. It ended 2-2 at Bramall Lane last night. Tottenham go through 3-2 on aggregate. As I say, Eriksen, the Spurs hero, scoring both goals, his second coming 2 minutes from the end to deny Sheffield United extra time. But despite the disappointment, Sheffield United are still in the FA Cup and chasing promotion, so it's a good season for their manager Nigel Clough.
Oh, it is, you know, a couple of new players signed in the last week or so. We want a couple more in before Monday night as well, but it is. We think we're on the up. Nights like tonight just reinforce that opinion. But congratulations to Maurizio. He's an excellent manager and I think a very good man as well.
Now, there's a remarkable story coming from the African Nations Cup. Guinea and Mali have no doubt this is dominating their news programmes this morning. They drew 1-1 in yesterday. They both have identical records. Now, only one team can go through to the quarterfinals. So this afternoon, they're going to draw lots to see which team goes through. And there's a horrible way not to go through. That's very unusual. It happened previously in 1988 in the African Nations Cup. Interestingly, in 1990, ourselves and the Dutch, I don't know if you remember the famous 1-1 draw we had with the Netherlands.
Yeah.
And in the wake of that, we had identical records.
Okay.
And lots were drawn. But that was to decide who would be first and who would be second. We were
both
going through.
Going in.
Whereas here,
one
of them will not go through, which is a tough way to lose. League of Ireland's First Division fixtures will be released today, no doubt eagerly anticipated by Dublin club Cabinteely, who were awarded an FEI licence yesterday to compete in the league next season. In Gaelic Games, a big win for Sligo IT in the Sigerson Cup last night. They beat Queens in Belfast after extra time, winning 1-9 to 8 points. GMIT had an excellent win over Dublin IT by 2 points in Tuam Stadium. Athlone beat Trinity by 3-10 to 10 points. Today there's a full programme in the Fitzgibbon Cup, and there's racing this afternoon in Thurles beginning at 1:35, and no doubt many tributes will be paid there to the course owner Pierce Maloney, who passed away on Tuesday.
Sad news indeed, Des. Thank you very much for the time. We'll go to the Dáil now, where opposition members walked out of the chamber yesterday afternoon over a decision to cancel a debate on a motion setting up an inquiry into incidents in the Cavan Monaghan Garda Division. It was cancelled after Ciarán Comhairle Seán Barrett told the parties some of the matters were sub judice. Conor McMurrow of our political staff has this report.
The debate on their proposed inquiry into claims of Garda malpractice was cancelled after Cancorla Sean Barrett ruled the matter was sub judice. As the matter has been considered by the courts, it would contravene the Dáil's operating rules to go ahead with the debate. But Fianna Fáil leader Micheál Martin questioned this decision.
I'm not aware of any case before a jury, so I do think we need an explanation as to the rationale of the Cancorlas, or behind the Cancorlas' decision, which essentially muzzles this House. And this is more than just the debate itself. It's about the status of this Parliament. It seems extraordinary that the Parliament is going to proceed with establishing an inquiry into issues of the most fundamental concern about the administration of justice, and there will be no debate. It's just incredible.
Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams stressed the importance of a debate.
There's been no real explanation for why we're told we cannot debate these issues, and it isn't good enough.
The Taoiseach outlined the government's position.
The government were happy to have a debate on the terms of reference. However, you have to understand that the Cancorla, in his independence, rules in respect of the standing orders of the House. And the Cancorla considered the matter very carefully. He considered the text of the motion tabled by the Minister for Justice. And the Cancorla pointed out to the Minister that he came to the conclusion that the motion is not in order for debate.
Independent TD Mick Wallace challenged the Taoiseach about his knowledge of correspondence from former Minister for Justice Alan Shatter.
I asked a question yesterday. Did you have a letter from Minister Shatter, from the former Minister? Yes. And both of you shook your heads. You didn't say anything, you just shook
That's
your heads.
Point no, of order, no, Deputy. No. Deputy Shatter wrote to the Cancorla on the 25th of November. My office received a copy of that letter on the 8th of December with a covering letter from the legal firm of solicitors, Gallagher Shatter. And in that letter, they requested that the reference in the terms of reference to the Minister for Justice and Equality would be withdrawn.
The row escalated with contributions from Deputy Martin and Sinn Féin's Kevin O'Callaghan.
I want some substantive answer from the Cancorla's office as to what is going on here.
I asked the Taoiseach how to explain how a decision of the House now not to proceed with this matter, deferring it for a number of days, would be in any way in conflict with the Cancorla's view. It would not be.
Last Cancorla Micheál Kit called a vote.
You put the vote to it now, Cancorla.
I'm the proposal now. Is the proposal agreed?
With that, the opposition staged a walkout and the Dáil was soon temporarily suspended. Afterwards, Micheál Martin, Gerry Adams and Mick Wallace spoke to the media on the Leinster House plinth.
You cannot have Parliament silenced in this manner, particularly in relation to the establishment of an inquiry.
I give the Taoiseach ample opportunity to reschedule this debate. He persisted in a bullheaded way that he was going to use his majority to push it through.
Yesterday, I asked the Taoiseach, and the Minister for Justice was by his side, I asked, was there any correspondence from the former Minister Shatter in relation to the pulling of this debate on the Commission of Investigation into the matters relating to Geirin? And both of them shook their head. You can check the camera. They didn't speak on it. They looked at each other and the two of them shook their heads. They misled the House.
And that was Mick Wallace, the independent TD, ending that report by Conor McMurrow. The time just coming up to 7:45. In a few moments is a new pay deal for consultants discriminatory.
The agreement between Health Minister Leo Varadkar and the Irish Medical Organisation over new consultants' pay has been described as discriminatory and will fail to attract high-calibre doctors to the posts. The criticism has come from the Irish Hospital Consultants Association, which didn't ballot its members on the increased pay proposal, nor did it take part in the Haddington Road pay talks of 2013. For doctors working exclusively in public hospitals, the new increased pay, the entry rate will be €127,000, rising to a maximum of €175,000. Doctors with experience can enter the service at €155,000. The association's president, Dr. Gerard Crotty, is on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the programme.
You represent existing consultants. Therefore, this new pay agreement doesn't affect your members. So why are you getting involved at this point?
Well, the most important people in this are patients. Patients are not getting the quality of care that they need. Waiting lists are growing rapidly, and there are patients waiting unnecessarily in emergency departments. And one of the reasons for this is that there are 300 consultant posts vacant. And these posts have been advertised already, but are not attracting applicants or sufficient applicants of suitable quality, so many of these posts just can't be filled. Mm,
but the Minister has said now, as a result of this new agreement, those posts will continue to be advertised and will be filled.
Well, talking to our potential members, senior trainees and consultants who are abroad, and there are a lot of very highly trained Irish medical specialists who are abroad, they have reacted to this deal with huge dismay. And we actually think that very few of them will want to work in a system where they will start on 20% less than their colleagues. And over a period of a number of years, their pay could increase, but they would be permanently on a lower salary than their colleagues who are doing exactly the same job. Mm. And, you know, that is actually poor management because, you know, whereas the health service has saved a lot by reductions in all salaries, including, I mean, all existing consultants have had major pay cuts. The amount they've saved by employing new entrants on these special reduced salaries has been minuscule, possibly just about 1 million. But in the meantime, they've spent 70 million in the last year on medical agency. So this is just extremely poor management. What is needed is to offer the same salary, the same terms and conditions as existing consultants. And that's not the only issue, in fact.
But why do you, again, back to that question, why do you care? I mean, the Irish Medical Organisation is the body which represents these people who will be applying for these consultants' posts.
Well,
your members probably far much more than what's
on
offer to these new entrants.
Well, we have members who are recently appointed on the reduced salaries, but we advocate for patients. And, you know, patients are suffering. Patients are not receiving the quality of care they need because of the huge number of vacant posts. And we don't think that these proposals will significantly address that.
But what do you say to those people who say to you that if your members, if consultants working in the public service, not exclusively but have private work as well, if they fulfilled their 39-hour-a-week contracts in the public service, that would help enormously?
Well, actually, the vast majority of consultants are fulfilling far more than their contractual hours, and they're often filling in for posts that are vacant on their service. There are many consultants I know who are in a group of three or four or five consultants, and there are one or two or three posts vacant. I mean, we are all familiar with the situation in the renal transplant unit, but this is happening in departments up and down the country. Mm-hmm. Consultants are putting in far more than their contractual
hours. Of course, undoubtedly there are many who are, but there are also many who aren't, and who aren't even fulfilling the contracts that they are due to fulfil in the public service.
Well, if there are, there are procedures within the existing contract, the 2008 contract, to deal with that. But that is not the issue. I mean, the vast majority of consultants are providing well above their contractual duties, but they cannot meet the needs of patients. The waiting lists are growing rapidly, and the large number of vacant posts is a very major contributor to this. And the current proposal, we feel, is not going to deal with that adequately at all.
Okay, thank you very much indeed, Dr. Gerard Crotty, President of the Irish Hospital Consultants Association. It's 9 minutes now to 8.
Audrey, Aer Lingus shares will start the day about 2% lower than they were this time yesterday. The shares finished the day at 237. They have been as high as 250, so the suggestion seems to be that investors are a little bit sceptical of what's going to happen now with the bid.
Are they saying it's all over?
No, not necessarily, but the closer the share price gets to the level of the bid, which is 255, including that 5 cent dividend, the more you can take it that investors are nearing certainty that it will go through. The corollary of that, of course, is the further it falls away from 250, 255, the more you can take it that there's a degree of scepticism there. But ultimately, the market has taken note of the fact that there remains a significant political hurdle and that this has very much now entered the realm of what the government deems acceptable and politically acceptable as regards what it does with its 25% stake. But it'll be interesting to watch that share price again.
Can the government block the sale, though, Conor?
If you were IAG, let's look at it this way. Do you want to buy 75% of an airline with a 25% shareholder there that from the discussions that have taken place to this point, if they do result in the government blocking or deciding not to sell its stake, is clearly opposed to some of what it believes you plan to do with the share. It's a lot less attractive as an asset, and you might be rethinking 255 if 25% of the shares remain beyond your control. Elsewhere in business news, Facebook will for the first time target users with real-time ads during Sunday's Super Bowl. That's the climax to the American football season, which is expected to be watched by more than 100 million viewers in the US alone. We're joined now by Ian Dodson, the co-founder of the Digital Marketing Institute. Good morning, Ian.
Morning.
We got results from Facebook overnight. Big surge in revenue over the fourth quarter of last year. Facebook also reckons about three quarters of those who will watch the game will also be looking at Facebook on a tablet or a smartphone, and it wants some of their money.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose most advertising spend globally is spent on what we call big brand advertising. And the Super Bowl really is the Olympics of big brand advertising in that sense. So what you have is large global brands spending anywhere from $5 million for a 30-second slot around the Super Bowl. And what Facebook wants to do is either wants to capture some of that money from them to shift it onto social media, or it wants them to actually use Facebook to amplify the message that they're getting across to their customers while they're dual screening as such. So what they're proposing is, in the past, what you used to be able to do is target people on Facebook with advertising based on either their likes or their profile or the demographics. Now what they're saying is, based on what you actually type into Facebook live, we will present either an advert or a link or a video to stuff that you're interested in.
So if you mention what you're eating during the Super Bowl, you're likely to get a food company or a beer company coming at you.
Precisely. And really what this is Facebook trying to depose Twitter as, I suppose, the king of the live and up-to-date and real-time platforms.
A couple of interesting things that came out of those Facebook results overnight. It works out at about $9 per user per quarter that they're earning in the US and Canada, but their overall advertising revenue per user is only $2.81, which is telling you that, I guess, outside the States, they're not making anywhere near as much money as they are in the US.
Yeah, I suppose it really is the 80-20 rule in that sense, and Facebook's revenue is very much coming from the US and Europe at this stage. You know, the results were great. I mean, I suppose the most important thing about the results was that mobile now accounts for about 70% of their ad revenue, and that was a real challenge for them over the past couple of years. But I suppose the greater challenge over the coming years is the fact that they own a lot of real estate. They have super saturated, I suppose, their newsfeed in Facebook. And I think they've squeezed as much as they possibly can out of their users at that point. And it really is a question of, well, can they bring the other, I suppose, pieces of web real estate that they have, like WhatsApp or Instagram or Messenger, into the fray and actually start generating some revenue out of those?
And the big question for Irish users, I suppose, will be, can we see this Super Bowl thing as a dry run for the real Holy Grail, which would be real-time advertising during the All-Ireland?
That's exactly it. We'll get the GAA on the line and see what they have to say about that.
Ian Dodson of the Digital Marketing Institute, thanks very much for coming into us this morning. In currency news, the euro trading at $1, 12.8 cents at present, and 74.5 pence sterling.
Connor, indeed, just coming up to 5 minutes to eight. If you haven't heard the AA Road Watch thus far, they have warned of black ice in some areas, so do be careful if you're driving. But for now, let's go over to Pat Clark at Met Aaron and get the rest of the day's weather.
Thank you. Hello, good morning everybody from Met Aaron. Well, the weather was very cold indeed last night. Some icy patches around, but also some sleet and snow showers, with the bulk of the snow over Ulster. The cold wintry theme will continue today, and the weather will be on the cold side right over the weekend and into the early days of next week, with temperatures below normal by day and also by night. But windy and bitterly cold for today, with showers of hail, sleet and snow at times. Most of the snow showers at the moment affecting Ulster and Connaught, and also just getting into the far north of Leinster. And there'll be some further accumulations of snow in places. These snow showers and sleet showers will push into Munster and South Leinster later this morning, largely falling as sleet, but a few snow flurries too in these parts. Top afternoon temperatures just 3 to 6 degrees, but feeling colder than that due to wind chill from the stiff west-northwesterly wind. Tonight will be cold and windy and quite blustery at times along the Atlantic seaboard. A spell of rain and sleet will move down across the country from the northwest during the night, falling as snow over parts of Ulster and Leinster, this mainly on high ground. Clearer, more showery conditions will follow from the northwest later tonight. Lowest temperatures close to zero, with some icy patches developing too. Tomorrow, Friday, will be cold and breezy, with a mixture of brighter sunny spells and showers. Most of the showers tomorrow of rain or hail, but perhaps a little sleet on high ground. Highs up slightly too, ranging 5 to 7 degrees, and winds will be fresh and gusty northwesterly. And as I said earlier, temperatures will stay below normal for the weekend and into the early days of next week. There'll be frost at night and icy roads as well. Winds in general will be north to northwesterly in direction. These will be fresh to strong and gusty at times. Now, there will be some brighter sunny spells both on Saturday and Sunday, but some showers about too. Most of the shower activity over the weekend will be in coastal areas of Leinster, Ulster and Connaught, and then parts of West Munster too. Most other areas getting very few showers. However, the showers that do occur will be mainly of rain and hail, but on occasion will fall a sleet or possibly snow at times, but it looks as if amounts of snow in general will be low. And just to recap before I go, bitterly cold and windy today. Showers of sleet and snow, mainly over Ulster, North Connaught and the far north of Leinster just now, will push southwards this morning. That's how the weather looks this morning.